This is Aesthetics Bites, a series for Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
Aesthetics Bites is made in association with the London Aesthetics Forum and made possible by a grant from the British Society of Aesthetics.
I think Mozart is a better composer than Beethoven. You disagree. I think Dickens is a better writer than Trollope. You disagree. I think Van Gogh is a better artist than Monet. You disagree. Is one of us right and one of us wrong? Here's Elizabeth Schellekens de Mun.
Elizabeth Schellekens de Mun, welcome to Aesthetics Bites.
Thank you very much for having me.
The topic we're going to focus on is disagreement about taste. I wonder if you could begin by giving an example of people disagreeing about taste.
Well, one of the most discussed or frequently used examples is an example that Hume outlines in his essay from 1757 of The Standard of Taste about a keg of wine. And two men, well-educated, cultivated men, who drink some of the wine in the keg and are asked to comment on the contents or the specific taste, describe their taste experience, as it were. And one of them refers to a slightly kind of metallic or iron taste in the wine. And the other one says that actually he can feel kind of a leathery taste in the wine. And they are more or less ridiculed by their audience, who think this is ridiculous, and it's probably used as also kind of a point about the snobbery of some people who have specific views about wine. But when they come to the end of the keg, they discover at the bottom of the keg that there is an iron key with a leather thong. What Hume uses this example to show is that, first of all, there is an analogy between what he calls mental taste and bodily taste. This is an example of bodily taste. Kind of objective features that we can detect in our experience that can explain and perhaps even justify our judgments of taste, of gustatory taste in that case. Now, in the aesthetic taste case, Hume says it works in a somewhat similar kind of way. There are features that we think or that seem to us to be objective features of the object of our appreciation that we can point to when we try to support our aesthetic judgments or our judgments about aesthetic taste.
So could you give an example of the kind of feature of, say, a painting that might give rise to this bodily sense, this bodily taste that you described?
Well, when we experience, for example, artworks aesthetically, we have a sensory impression, we have a perceptual response, and we might want to justify or explain or support our aesthetic judgments. And we do that, as do art critics, of course, by appealing to all sorts of qualities and features in the object that we're experiencing. So some of those features will be fairly uncontroversial, like colour or shape or size, or just the way in which certain parts of a painting, for example, relate to one another. And other features will be what we call aesthetic qualities or aesthetic features. And they might have to do with the harmony of the colours, the balance in certain aspects of the composition, and so on.
So if I'm looking at a Rembrandt self-portrait, I can talk about the brownish colours in the background, let's say, and we all agree which colours are used on that painting. We can agree about the size of the painting. But when I say this is exquisite brushwork, the notion of it being exquisite is an aesthetic judgment. And then we disagree. And I don't understand how we can ever get over that disagreement.
Well, I'd say the first thing to start thinking about when we come across a case like that is really what we mean by disagreement. Is it really a disagreement in the sense that we actively disagree? I think this artwork has this aesthetic value or this aesthetic quality, and you think it doesn't. So are we engaging kind of contradictory opinions here? Is that what we're doing? You think it has something, I think it doesn't have it. Another question we should ask is how deeply this disagreement runs. Could it be that we're just disagreeing in terminological disagreement, that we perhaps mean slightly different things by the words that we use, and perhaps we can reach an agreement once we've clarified those issues? Another thing is, what kind of disagreement is it we're really having? Is it a purely aesthetic disagreement in terms of its aesthetic value? Because we have many different kinds of aesthetic judgments, some of which are comparisons. We also have what we call aesthetic verdicts, which are more final or general judgments about something's overall aesthetic value. We have judgments that just ascribe a particular property to an artwork. We have plenty of different kinds of aesthetic judgments. So the first thing I would say is we need to get a little bit more into the detail of what kind of disagreement we actually have and what's at stake here.
Okay, well, let's make it easy. I say it's a great painting. You say it's a terrible painting. Mm-hmm. That's a disagreement at a very general level. How do we resolve that? Or how does Hume think we can resolve it, at least?
Well, the first thing I think Hume would say is that he would need some kind of assurance that we are really exercising our faculty of taste, as he would call it here, so that we're not just engaged in personal preferences or kind of idiosyncratic inclinations. This is not the case of I tend to prefer this kind of artist or this kind of artwork and you tend to prefer something else. That we're operating this faculty, which he calls the faculty of taste, and that we are in the overall position that he wants us to be when we exercise that taste, so that we're free of prejudice, we have training in these matters, we can compare adequately, we have good sense and some other features that he outlines. And if we're then, after all that, still disagreeing, then we come to what critics or art critics do every day, which is to start supporting our judgments by pointing to the features of the artwork. Now, those features can be, as I said, features that are uncontroversially in the object in some sense, or aesthetic qualities of the artwork, but they can also bring in various features about historical context in general. So then it becomes a kind of may the best person win the aesthetic argument by appealing to features that are, at least in principle, available to all.
So if I like a particular Rembrandt self-portrait because it reminds me of my grandfather, that's a kind of irrelevant idiosyncrasy about me. If I'm highly prejudiced because I'm Dutch, I love Dutch art, and I think Rembrandt's the greatest because he's Dutch, and that's another irrelevancy in this case. If I haven't had much experience at looking at paintings, I've seen a few Rembrandts but never looked at any other artist's work, you might question my judgment. Those are the sorts of things which get in the way of making a good aesthetic judgment. Is that right?
Well, I'd say that your first example is definitely not a judgment of aesthetic taste for Hume. It is, as you said, just a kind of a personal preference. The second case is a bit more complicated because you might not be aware of your own prejudice, right? So you might think that you're in an excellent position to take on this aesthetic perspective that Hume wants us to take, but you are simply unable to because, for example, your attachment to Holland is too great, right? So that could be a case of a personal preference, but it could also be a case of a less appropriate or perhaps even incorrect judgment of aesthetic taste.
So what about the third? The fact that I've only looked at paintings by Rembrandt in my life, I've never looked at any other artist's work.
But that raises an interesting question because Hume is very clear. He outlines these five criteria. The first is good sense. The second is a delicacy of sentiment, a certain kind of refinement in that way. Then practice in exercising that refinement. And then, of course, having no prejudice whatsoever in your aesthetic experience. And also comparison, or being able to compare with other artworks, so having that ability of comparison. There are some examples where our aesthetic impression is strengthened, or in some sense, at least more valuable, if we come to it without this baggage of knowledge or understanding and are struck by its aesthetic value without any kind of cognitive associations strengthening that experience. So I think that's a difficult case for Hume.
So is Hume saying that what we should do if we're not ideal critics, if we don't have all those qualities, is listen to the critics and let them make the judgments? Or is he saying something else? Is he saying that we should train ourselves to be those kind of critics if we want to engage with art?
The idea is that we should aspire to be ideal critics. But Hume is not so exercised about our kind of aesthetic well-being, as it were. But really, it is a kind of philosophical problem about trying to reconcile two seemingly opposing or different assumptions that we have about our aesthetic experiences. On the one hand, we seem to disagree about taste all the time, and that's just an observable fact. And on the other hand, there seem to be some aesthetic judgments that are just better or more spot on than others.
So if somebody says to me, look, Sid Vicious is a greater composer than Schubert, they're just wrong.
Well, I can't speak for what Hume would say about Sid Vicious, but it would be more fair to anyone who, like Hume, tries to take this problem as a philosophical problem and take it very seriously, to compare two composers that are roughly in the same ballpark, say Beethoven and Bach. Is the oeuvre of one of those composers better than the other? For Hume, most probably, yes.
Does that mean there's an objective answer? You play a violin concerto by Bach and you play one by Beethoven, you compare them, and one is better than the other, and it's objective?
In a sense, yes, because what he's trying to establish is an objective standard of taste. But what do we mean by objective? In one sense, he is a philosopher who wants to encourage us to take our subjective experiences very seriously in terms of the access they give us to the world and what we can understand about the world through our subjective experiences. And of course, aesthetic and moral judgments are, in one sense, fundamentally subjective for Hume. But he's trying to establish a standard. You could call it intersubjective or you could call it objective. But the important thing is that it's not going to be objective in the sense of a law of nature, for example. And it won't just point at entirely objective features of the objective experience. But it is a standard which is applicable and which holds for more than just one person, right? It holds for all of us, and it holds for ideal critics from across time and across cultures.
He's got this notion of the test of time, that great works of art pass the test of time.
That's right. And when we think about Hume's aesthetic theory, it's very easy to start thinking about these ideal critics which have fulfilled or have met these five criteria he outlines very, very strictly and so on, as a bourgeois elite of Western culture. And it's easy to forget in all that the true critics, or the standard of taste which relies on the sentiments of the true critics, is one that must hold across time and also to a certain extent across cultures. So they have to stand the test of time. That's to say, they have to be able to evoke these sentiments of approbation, sometimes across centuries. And it is a mark of an aesthetically valuable artwork that it does pass this test of time.
Kant also is very interested in the question about disagreements of taste and how we might reconcile the subjective individual judgment with the sense that when we make some of these judgments, we are definitely right about them, that it's objectively true that a particular artist is a greater artist than another, a particular work is greater than another. It's not just a matter of dispute about taste, it's really true.
Right, so in a certain respect, Kant addresses the same problem in his aesthetic theory as Hume does in his Of the Standard of Taste, namely how to combine, as you say, the subjectivity of our aesthetic experience with the objectivity or the seeming objectivity of our aesthetic judgments. Aesthetic judgments have a normative force, that's to say, when we are compelled to agree with them or there's a certain kind of ought about them, it's not as simple as the kind of gustatory taste, where it's absolutely fine to say, well, you like apples and I like pears. Kant specifically mentions that in the case of beauty, it is not true that every man has his own taste. At the same time, there are no rules for beauty. There are no principles of taste or rule of thumb that we can apply either to make a fantastic artwork or to know when something is beautiful, be it art or non-art. This attempt to combine the subjectivity of the aesthetic experience with the seeming objectivity of the aesthetic judgment is something that both Kant and Hume are trying very hard to get to grips with. Now, Kant's answer will rely on what he calls a sensus communis, or the common sense. That's to say that we're all pretty much made up cognitively or psychologically in the same kind of way. And the fact that we all have the same mental abilities or cognitive faculties, as Kant would call them, makes us equal candidates to experience aesthetic value in a fair and democratic way. So we have this basic common sense in place, which helps us understand why, when you say that X is beautiful, and I feel the normative force of that judgment, I am, at least in principle, capable of seeing or experiencing what you're experiencing. Now, it might take some time, it might take some work, it might take some patience, But you could say that we're all aesthetic agents if we want to be. And so the subjectivity of the experience is also combined with this objectivity, or as I mentioned before, what we might want to call an intersubjectivity. The important point being not so much exactly which term we should pick here, perhaps, as the fact that it's valid for other people too.
Isn't this just hopelessly optimistic about human universals, both in terms of Hume and Kant, because it assumes that I can really understand art from any culture, that I can understand the motivations and the judgments that people make in another culture, but actually, even the notion of art may be something very different in another culture.
No, I think that's right. And of course, that's not an issue that troubles Hume and Kant very much, being European men of the 18th century. But I think it's a point that's important to us today. We're under much greater pressure to take into account different kinds of art, different kinds of art histories. And it raises a question about whether the relation between art and aesthetic value can be given one unified answer. You know, you might want to say that if we want to bring in Aboriginal art, cave art, European expressionism, all under one roof, we're expecting too much from our philosophical theories, that they'll be able to accommodate all those cases perfectly. So where do we go from there? Do we want to say that there can be no such thing as one definition of art, but there are different kinds of art to call for definition? Should there be different explanations of how art relates to aesthetic value? I mean, after all, there are plenty of examples of contemporary European art, valuable artworks, that don't particularly have aesthetic value or don't even aim to have aesthetic value. So I think, in a sense, on the 21st kind of century philosopher has to deal with a whole host of questions that Hume and Kant didn't have to worry about.
I'm really intrigued to know what you think about disagreements about taste. We've talked about what Hume and Kant thought about the issue. What do you think is the solution to the problem, or what seems to be a problem, that people disagree about taste, but they also usually feel very strongly that they're right in their judgments in particular cases?
Well, I think it's a phenomenon that we're all familiar with. I think that there is a real onus on us to disentangle the various aspects of an aesthetic disagreement when it does arise. Assuming that we clarify all of that, I think it's incredibly important that we come as far as we can in our discussions and not drop them. I mean, there is this common idea that aesthetic disagreement doesn't matter in the same kind of way as moral disagreement might. And of course, there are cases in which you might think, well, lives could be at stake with moral disagreements, and with aesthetic disagreements, what's really at stake? But I think that's too simple an answer. Our aesthetic judgments say a lot about who we are and who we want to be. Certainly when we begin our life as an adult, it's incredibly important to us that we share aesthetic tastes with our friends. It can be difficult to maintain a friendship with someone who has entirely different aesthetic tastes. And I think that we should do well to remind ourselves of that the occurrence of disagreement as such doesn't tell us anything. What we need to think carefully about is also the issues I mentioned earlier, but what kind of disagreement is it? And the way in which our aesthetic disagreements tie in very closely, I think, with other commitments, such as moral views and moral positions. You might think that someone who shares your aesthetic taste also shares a life view, and someone who has an entirely different set of aesthetic parameters might well be someone that you don't share some of those very important things with. It's not always the case, of course, but it might well be the case. So I think our aesthetic disagreements reveal a lot more than we tend to assume about what's important to us.
But is there any objective truth in our judgments? Is there the equivalent of the key at the bottom of the barrel somewhere?
Right, well, assuming that, as I said, that we are not talking about aesthetic preferences and that this is a bona fide aesthetic judgment, I think that there is a kind of correctness or appropriateness to be had. I think there are features in the object that we appreciate aesthetically that we can and we should point to in support of our aesthetic judgments. And I think that some qualities and some features, the way in which they interact and work together in certain artworks, for example, make certain value judgments more appropriate or more true, if you want to use that word, than others. What we do need to think about is what we mean by true and what we mean by objective, of course, and there would have to be some qualifications. This is not the truth or the objectivity of the natural sciences, but it is an important point nonetheless that we need to explore further.
Elizabeth Schillings-Demann, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more information about Aesthetics Bites, go to www.londonaestheticsforum.org.
And for more information about Philosophy Bites and how to support us, go to www.philosophybites.com.